Well, what I'm interested in the book is what happens when people who have different ideas about how the world works come together and then have to figure out how to live in the same landscapes. So it's really about that. It's, you know, the kind of understandings you have about what matters and what's real. And if they differ, which in the early early contact period between Māori and Europeans, they certainly did, how you negotiate that and how you build what you might call bridges of intelligibility so you can make some sense of each other.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, because the book focuses somewhat on these like interpersonal and interdependent relationships between, you know, Māori and early British settlers in the sort of prehistory period, you know, special sort of concentrations on these ideas of and concepts of whakapapa and ho. I mean, do you think there's sort of a shift now in interest or scholarship even towards thinking about our early history in this way as a sort of give-take relationship?
Perhaps it's something that has is emerging because I see it probably more in the sciences, funnily enough. So in many of the sciences, like the biological and environmental sciences, you've got people who are doing collaborative projects about rivers or about biodiversity or the restoration of tiki or something like that, and they're collaborating very actively with Māori communities and experts who think about these things in very Māori ways and see, for example, a river as a living being. that sort of difference of perception.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you mentioned that in sort of your afterword about how these sort of themes and the way of thinking about this comes out in the sciences, and that there sort of needs to be a combination between, you know, thinking about this in terms of science and in terms of how we study it in arts disciplines.
Yes, well, I think these kinds of experiments are happening actually a lot in New Zealand at the moment, especially among younger scholars and younger people, where... as I mentioned, for example, what's becoming the very famous case of the Whanganui River, where legal thinkers came up with the idea, and Jacinta Rūru was a leader in this respect down in Otago, and came up with the idea of actually recognising the Māori perception of a river as an ancestor or a living system, actually, is probably more accurate. And figuring out how to do that in a legal framework so that you could then set up systems in order to take care of the river into the future with its communities. And I think these kinds of experiments are fascinating. There's a lot of promise there for different ways of relating to the wider world that we occupy and our relationships with each other.
Definitely. And I mean, one thing that I really enjoyed was your discussion of sort of the different universes was really interesting. And I mean, excuse the sort of simplification here. But I mean, you talk about, you know, the European ideas of universe and time, its hierarchical sort of order. But you also talk about Māori conceptions of time and universe, you know, which sort of works in a spiral almost. I mean, what can you tell me about this? How do they compare? And also, I mean, should we be comparing them?
Well, I think we do, just in practical terms, because when you're dealing with, for example, Māori ways of thinking about ancestors, or, for example, particular taonga, it's really very clear that when you're in a practical situation with an ancestral carving, and you're there with a group of people who are descended from that ancestor, and I was in this situation in New York just recently when we went with a group of people from Hauiti, from Tolaga Bay, to meet their ancestor Paikea in the back stacks of the American Museum of Natural History. And that was not an encounter between a group of living descendants and a piece of wood. I mean, it was absolutely... it was just so powerful. It was an encounter with their ancestor. And that's a very different way of thinking about the relationship between, you know, what in Western or modernist thinking you would say is things that are inanimate and people, for example.
Yeah, definitely. I thought the chapter, I mean, the story of Hongeheka and Thomas Kendall is a fantastic one, really. You know, sort of these two men who really delved into opposite worlds and, you know, were changed by it.
Completely, and explored. When you think about, you know, Kendall and Hongeheka, I think it's a very poignant story because in a way those attempts that they made that were so serious and so profound to understand each other's ways of being, it destabilized both of them in different ways. You know, Kendall, obviously, as a missionary who came to think that Māori philosophy was sublime, you know, and really delved into te reo, tried to grasp Māori conceptions of ancestry, collected carvings and sent them back to the Church Missionary Society in London, trying to convince them that Māori philosophy was something which was to be taken in a very serious light. He wrote to them and tried to convey this sense of philosophical admiration that he felt. And their response, of course, was to regard him as a missionary who'd lapsed, you know, who'd fallen under the sway of Satan, and of course he got kicked out of the Missionary Society and sent back to Australia, and his life completely unravelled. Whereas Hongi, but the two of them before then had gone to Britain and met up with King George IV and been to Cambridge and talked to Professor Lee, and Hongi had helped Professor Lee and Kendall to write the first grammar of Māori, and it's a really fine, it's actually a really fine piece of work too, because I've looked at it and read it. So the experiments that they entered into kind of knocked them off their moorings in some ways, and Kendall, I think, never really kind of recovered his balance exactly, whereas Hongi in the end decided that his own way of life and his own society was preferable to what he'd seen in Britain, and came back and was, you know, a Māori patriot, you might say.
Yes, it's almost like he was like empowered by his experiences. I mean, even the thought of Hongihika travelling to Britain is astounding. You know, it's a fascinating story. So you look at these themes, sort of land, sea, etc., through this historical lens at the start of the book, and then but you also, you know, put it in a contemporary ones with, as you've mentioned before, the river having a personhood. And what was the sort of purpose of this?
Well, I was really, I was trying to use the idea, I think, although the book's quite philosophical, it's also a lot about storytelling, because I didn't want to kind of make it a very abstract, you know, kind of esoteric, inaccessible piece of writing. I wanted people to be able to understand some of the thought worlds for themselves, if you like, and to do that, storytelling is really important. And so I wanted to be able to use the idea of the spiral of space-time in the way I wrote the book. And that's what particularly sort of happened in that second section of the book, where I'm writing about freshwater debates, but kind of from first encounters right into the present and the future. And the same thing with the ocean, our relationships with the sea and with land, and then with each other, and especially men, women and children. And in the process, you know, trying to, through storytelling and through exploring particular episodes, and sometimes ones in which I've been involved myself, share that that sense of the different realities, really, you know, with readers, but also to open up ways of thinking which might carry us into better futures.
Yeah, I thought it was just a small comment in the Voyaging Stars in the afterwards about how, you know, these virtual networks of communications you know, sprawl around the world, which, you know, ignoring national borders and sort of disrupting these space-time distinctions. I thought that was, you know, a really interesting and a really good point.
Well, Whakapapa works like that, actually. It's you know, when you're I had the good fortune to be very close for about 20 years with Eruetta Sterling, and he was had been trained in the old schools of learning, and he was really somebody that thought in a whakapapa way, you might say. Mm. And what whakapapa is like is it's like this kind of relational series, very complex, dynamic set of relational networks based on reciprocal exchange. So it can be between people and among people, but equally it can be between a group of people in a river or a mountain or a particular piece of land. And we're seeing that those kinds of understandings of how the world works, on the one hand tracking into law in New Zealand with the Whanganui River settlement, but also the Uruwera settlement, which treats the Uruwera as an ancestral, an ancestor, a living territory, you might say, but equally in the cutting-edge biological sciences with complex systems theory. And as you say, with the internet, and I mean, these are relational systems that work in ways that are not the same, but they're resonant with Māori philosophies. So it's interesting what happens when you bring them together and let them mutually spark off each other.
Yeah, definitely. It's a fascinating way of thinking about it, I think. And also, I guess I just want to sort of end by asking, what does this book mean? What does this book mean for you?
Ah, well, you know, I first got involved in Te Ao Māori when I was 17. You know, I probably knew a bit about it before then, but not much. But very seriously involved since I've been a teenager. And it's been a lifetime of exploration, you know, and journeys and trying to understand this way of being in the world and through all kinds of different lenses, you might say, and different relationships. And in a way, it's come together in this book. A lot of those different adventures I've been on, for example, in the environmental space, I've had quite a lot to do with debates about freshwater climate change, increasingly over how we relate to the Pacific Ocean and climate change in the Pacific Ocean. And those things I'm very practically involved with, but equally drawing on Māori philosophy to inform the things that, you know, that I've been saying about them or working with others. And so the book is a kind of, brings all that together. You know, it's kind of like your whole life, sort of, all the different strands weave together in one piece of writing, which is pretty exciting. And yes, it wasn't the most, it was quite a profound book to try and write.